Welcome to season four of the Spotlight series, Don't Just Survive, Thrive. My name is Nicola Steele, founder of JJP Talent Solutions, an Australian IT recruitment company. With over 20 years' expertise, I provide insights on how you can transform your career to the next level. This podcast was born out of the 2020 global pandemic. Season one was launched to help people through the pandemic by talking to a variety of experts about topics such as psychology, finance, and health. Season two focused on more work-related issues, including HR, marketing, and leadership. Season three centered on the IT industry, where I talked to startup founders and senior IT people who revealed the secrets to their success. And now it's time for season four. This season continues the focus on tech leaders, as well as startup and scale-up founders, about their stories and insights. I hope you enjoy listening. I'm delighted to introduce Rav Raniger. Rav is partner lead at tech startup Ilara AI, a programmable AI platform, and he has previously worked at Skopta and Biari. Rav has extensive expertise in mathematics and algorithmic software solutions. He has the ability to deconstruct complex problems and create elegant solutions using customer-centric design. Rav, thank you for joining me on season four, episode three of the Spotlight series, Don't Just Survive, Thrive.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Nicola.
Thank you. And it's a pleasure to see you again, Rav. So, Rav, tell me a little bit more about your background and your personal story.
Well, number one, I hate feeling like my own life's a story, but I'll start explaining it nonetheless. So I guess my own upbringing was quite privileged, reasonably upper middle class, had a really stable family life. And so didn't really have like a fight or flight type upbringing. Really didn't have to worry too much about questions of survival or self-worth and things like that. So it was quite privileged, and that's relative to other people in my family. So like, for example, like my dad grew up in Fiji and he had quite a strong family life, but didn't grow up with a lot of money and grew up quite poor in Fiji, and with a lot of hard work and a lot of grit, a lot of smarts, and also a lot of like support from family and from scholarships and things like that. He was able to go to school in New Zealand. And then from that, he was able to go to uni and became a pharmacist. And with a lot of luck, but also a lot of strategy and hard work, he was able to do quite well. And I think by age 40, he was out of pharmacy and he decided to do law. And he's a lawyer now. Oh. Age 60 now, he's a lawyer. So wow. I do look up to my dad as a bit of a role model in a lot of ways. But it's also quite different to my own life because I didn't have to struggle with so many struggles that he had to go through.
And do you think he gave you your work ethic?
Definitely a perspective on work ethic, for sure. Mm-hmm. The way I think about work is probably ingrained from just spending time with my dad. My dad worked quite hard as a pharmacist and worked a lot of hours, but my brother and I, and my mum worked in the pharmacy as well, and my brother and I were around all the time. So we were able to actually, you know, you never know what sorts of things you kind of pick up along the side, right? But like, yeah. It's obviously a lot of things kind of ingrained in you from just by exposure to the environment. I also got around a lot with my dad when we were younger, so I got to see a lot of that. But yeah, for sure. Like, I think the thing for me at least was that like, I didn't have to worry so much about the financial concerns and of survival and taking care of a family myself. So I was more able to focus on kind of more of the kind of cultural concerns like arts and sciences when I was at school. And that's the sorts of interests that I had, right? So I was always interested in like, how do things work? How does the universe work? And that's in that kind of way, I got really into the sciences through uni and then did an undergrad degree in biotechnology and mathematics and kind of started to stare towards this thing that was interesting at the time, which was this really the psychology of the way people make decisions and how people make decisions. And there was this really nice subject at university that I did, which was really focused on the science of decision-making. And from then, I just kind of got stuck deep into this, like, how do we make better decisions? What is the kind of insights into better decisions? Why aren't organizations thinking about decision-making in a really, like, evidence-based way with mathematics, with with these kind of more scientific approaches to decision making. And then, yeah, just like it just kind of exploded from there. So I did a lot of work. My first job was with a company called Biari, which I worked at for quite a few years, and took me to a lot of different sectors where I was able to see lots of different problems, but all like the same flavor of the problem. So just the same flavor of the thing that I was seeing and starting to get exposed to at university, which was this real scientific way of being able to make decisions and data-driven way of making decisions. But there's not a lot of people and across every single sector that are using these types of methodologies. And that was kind of curious to me, is why aren't people using these types of strategies? And what is the way that people are making decisions at the moment, and can they value from it?
Absolutely. And I think Biari, was that where you worked in the UK? And I think you worked in, was it Scandinavia?
Yeah, so I worked in the UK for a while. So that was focused on, so I worked for a division of Biari that focuses on fiber optic network deployments. So things like the NBN, or in the US, AT&T and Google Fiber, all those sorts of companies deploying fiber networks. And that's traditionally always been like a very like manual thing. People draw lines on CAD to work out how they should be deploying their fiber optic network. But there's real mathsy ways that they can work out what's the best way that they can be doing things, so that like when they're digging along trenches along the sides of roads, they're minimizing disruption and minimizing the amount of dig and stuff. So I did a bunch of that stuff for a few years, did a bunch of stuff in different countries as well. So was really lucky, got the opportunity to go to South Africa, the US, a bit of stuff in Germany and Spain as well. But yeah, moved into shipping. So a lot of the same problems that they were having in these kind of more engineering focused disciplines, same sorts of problems in the maritime space. So shipping companies with lots of ships, working out how they should deploy those ships, all things that they could be using maths to help with their decision making. I lived in Norway in the end for two years.
So, Norway, yeah.
Yeah.
I also hadn't imagined Scandinavia. I couldn't remember which Scandinavian country it was. And I think what I really like is it's not just maths from your perspective, maths for maths' sake. It's about the people aspect as well, the decision-making, how it impacts people, which is, I mean, that's what I'm all about. So I love it bringing that in. And as you mentioned before about science and also art as well, there's a place for both of them. Awesome. Well, thank you for that, Rav. And now you're at Elara AI and have been there for a while now. So tell me a little bit more about the purpose, the mission, the vision behind Elara.
So when we're talking about Elara, there's kind of different layers in which we can talk about Elara. So there's problem that Elara is seeking to solve, and there's really the how it's seeking to solve it. And so really the problem that we're talking about is whenever you've got any kind of organization or any sort of business, any sort of place where there's lots of decision-making happening. I mean, this is going to sound really obvious, but the outcomes that any organization is going to get is going to depend purely on the quality of the decisions that they're making, right? If they're making good decisions, they're going to get good outcomes. Making bad decisions, they're going to get bad outcomes, right? And the best organizations within a sector are making decisions a lot better than the worst companies within a sector, right? That can be due to a lot of reasons, right? There can be really poor accountability of decision-making. Like, let's just say if there's a part of an organization that's not operating so well, then other parts of that organization can hide their inefficiencies underneath that the bigger umbrella of the worst part of the organization. You can have poor incentives. So you can have different silos within an organization. You can have like one part of the organization making really good decisions for their part, but it's just producing bottlenecks up the road, right? You got those types of things. But one thing that's kind of overlapping across a lot of these things are insights. So what are the types of insights that people are using to make decisions? Are they using good insights? Are they using accurate insights? Are they using like a broad range, like a really good context of insights? And if they're using a really good range, they're using really complete information, up-to-date information, and really accurate information, then that gives them the best chance that they can be making good decisions. And this stuff isn't new, right? So like a lot of organizations focus on this area. So there's this area called prescriptive analytics, which is all about giving people the best insights that they can to be able to make good decisions. And these are like what decisions they should be making. I've been doing this for a number of years, right? Like I've been doing this with Biari and with Scopter as well, solving these kind of prescriptive insights within different sectors. And the thing that's that I started to see across the different areas that I was working in is I'm a technical person, right? Like I work in a technical domain. And a lot of the problems that I was solving for people would be in a problems that people have in the business domain, right? And so mm-hmm. there's business people who run the business or run operations or run part of the business. They think about their problems really intuitively. They think about the different parts of their business unit and the different interplay between, you know, let's just say people and processes. And they have a really clear understanding of how this interdependence plays out. Like if they make a change here in their business, how it's going to make an outcome here. And people like me, we're more about applying like mathematical strategies or trying to build structure where there's not really much structure and trying to think about the world and try to put the world into like a box, nice little box that we can categorize the world in, right? And that kind of, there's this big gap between those two worlds. Like there's yes. business people and then there's like the technical people. And that's really hard to bridge that gap, right? Because it's just like I'm talking about things in a completely different language than business people are talking about things. And the crazy thing about Alara was just that Alara is all about bridging that gap. It's all about giving digital people, data scientists and developers, all of the tools and the skill sets to be able to then start solving problems in the business domain. That's where I guess like the real value proposition of Alara is. Alara does prescriptive analytics, and there's other systems that do prescriptive analytics, but Alara really focuses on bridging that gap in a really meaningful way.
So it's, yeah, bridging that gap between the techies and the business people.
Yeah, yeah.
Having them speak the same language.
Yeah, giving them I want to use the word framework almost, yeah. or a really strong strategy, like a templatized strategy that they can then go into, and then they can repeat this, right? They can go into different organizations and different businesses and be able to start to see the world in a different way, in a way that's more than just the tools and the technologies, right? The numbers that they have in their heads and being able to apply a broader set of skills that then apply to the business people.
Absolutely. Fantastic. And it's such a unique product and such an exciting stage for you at the moment. And with regards to the culture at Alara, because you were one of the initial people that joined, what are your core values and how do they drive the culture there at Alara?
So one of the main ones is we're really focused on improving the developer experience. So we're all technical people. So when it comes to developers, software developers, data scientists, engineering background. So we're all about, at some point in our careers, have been focused on delivering solutions to people and making sure that they work. And we're all involved in that at this stage with Alara as well. So we're building the system that we want to be able to then roll out to the world, right? Mm-hmm. And we want those people to be able to benefit from Alara in a way that, like, we can fully understand what benefit they're getting and then make sure that the experience of them delivering solutions for themselves are as amazing as we want them to be.
Perfect. So you're effectively the target customer to a certain extent.
Yeah, yeah. So we've been working in this space for a long time. So we know what sorts of problems that we face when we've used other technologies or tried to solve problems in different ways. So building a technology where we're also the ones who are the customers who have that kind of lens keeps us really close to our end users.
Absolutely. And Rav, in terms of AI, machine learning, data optimization, what are your future predictions over the next 5-10 years, would you say?
So what I would personally focus on is more of that this kind of prescriptive insights area. So a lot of organizations and the way that they do decision making in that kind of a space, what we're starting to see is a lot of big consulting firms starting to build up capability in that space. So they're building up teams of data scientists and developers to be able to solve these types of problems as value adds within their core consulting practices. I mean, a lot of these organizations, they see these problems, right? So for them, the next step is just adding that capability and being able to really spin the wheel and be able to then churn out lots of really smart solutions to these types of problems and do it really quickly and effectively. So that's really where we see a lot of the kind of decision optimization kind of space going, where it's starting to become a lot more kind of commoditized in terms of the skill sets and the capabilities. And then we're starting to see all of these kind of skill sets being gobbled up by these sorts of organizations. Mm-hmm. And what they're kind of missing is the sorts of the tools that they would need to be able to do this effectively and do this at scale. And that's really what we're focusing with Alara is, okay, if we can help these people do these things at scale rather than kind of piecemeal. And, you know, sometimes I've been part of this, right, where like you'll work on a project and a project will go really well and you'll have some nice learnings from that and you can kind of start to democratize those learnings. But then it's a whole other level to try to do it at scale across your whole team with the varying levels of skill sets, varying levels of experience. And that's where a lot of these organizations are trying to head to, is really commoditize this thing.
Absolutely. And scale from that perspective.
Yeah, because there's so many organizations that have these problems, right? And this is going to be a problem for a long time across a lot of different organizations. And you know, you've got people at the real far end of the curve. You've got the early adopters who've been starting to implement a lot of this stuff and, you know, worked with a lot of those sorts of organizations. But then a lot of organizations that are still kind of dragging their heels when it comes to digitization. And they're the ones that we're starting to work with now too. So
absolutely. And I think, I don't mean to mention the dreaded C word, COVID, but that did really speed up digitization and everything. It was forced upon people. But you've still, as you say, you've still got the laggards that are trailing behind.
Yeah, I think that was probably a big, almost a boon, that space, because it's like, it's shown that, okay, it's not as scary. It might be a lot of work to implement this stuff and there might be a lot of blood involved to try to get at these things across the line. But at the end of the day, this stuff is making people more effective at their jobs. It's getting better outcomes across their jobs. And then you're starting to now, I mean, that's even just with simple kind of descriptive statistics, right? So if an organization has a really clear understanding of what's going on in their business right now, it's taken a lot of organizations a lot of effort to get to the kind of that point, right? Where they can actually just see what's going on now and start to then piece together what the reasons why things happened. And it's kind of, we're starting to see now organizations start to grow along the curve where they're starting to build this capability, not just in these kind of earlier stages, being able to know what's going on now, but what can we then predict is going to happen in the future and then what decisions we should be making.
So looking at what's happening now, looking at the past, then predict what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Absolutely. Awesome. And coming back to you, Rav, what would you say are the highlights of your career so far?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of different exciting things. So I've been able to do a lot of, the interesting thing for me was I went and did mathematics at uni because I was good at maths and I liked the types of questions and that was helping solve and it gave me a better understanding of how things stitch together in terms of the physical world. And that was quite cool, but I never planned on, had like an end game in sight, right, when I did this. So I was just kind of like, okay, well, I'll go and do maths at university and I did biotech as well. I didn't have an end game. And a lot of people would always ask me, are you going to be a maths teacher, get out of uni? And I was like, oh, I don't feel like that's the plan. But I didn't quite know. And I think I've been really lucky in the way that the sector has kind of gone, because that skill set has been particularly broad and useful across a range of different areas. Mm-hmm. And I've been really lucky that like I've been able to use it in the way I've been able to use it, because like it's given me a lot of opportunity to do travel. It's helped me solve lots of really cool problems and work across sector as well. So not be kind of tied down into one particular sector, work in consulting and work in like kind of third party project delivery. And it's also like helped me, like one of the other highlights has also been that it's given me the opportunity to work with some pretty cool people as well. Mm-hmm. So that's probably been probably that's the most exciting thing, I think, is that like there's just so many different types of people you meet in the type of project delivery space. And it's people from all sorts of different backgrounds, and everyone sees the world so differently. And you're kind of starting to explore how we can like recommend our vision of the world and how we can kind of merge those two worlds together. And that to me has been probably the most exciting part is, just the people side, you know. So
meeting really interesting, smart people and exchanging ideas, potentially growing them as well and all that kind of aspect.
And smart in different ways, you know, smart in so many different ways. For myself, like university in a particular technical discipline, which kind of rewards a lot of kind of almost, I would say, algorithmic thinking. So if you can start to learn something and understand the rules behind how something's happening, behind how something's working, and then being able to apply those rules in particular ways, you're kind of rewarded for that. And in lots of other disciplines, that's not particularly a useful trait, and especially in more creative disciplines, right? Like there's sometimes a technical aspect in the arts, but there's also other aspects, which is you know, things like associative memory and being able to combine lots of different thinking from lots of different areas and being able to, like, you know, combine that into creative work, right? Which is kind of exciting stuff, which is not always as common in at least the way that a lot of these mathematical disciplines are taught.
Absolutely. I was just thinking about something my daughter said. She's nearly 17, but thinking of, it was about art, and her teacher had said, first, to break the rules, you must know the rules. Okay. Which I thought was really interesting. You can't break them if you don't know them, so you need to learn them quite rigorously to then break them and do something different.
From a learning, she's talking about an awareness of the rules, like awareness of these things.
I think it was the particular arts that they were doing at that particular moment in time. This is a little while ago, I thought it was quite interesting that at school you're told to follow the rules, aren't you? And this teacher was saying, yes, you need to know that, but then you can break them with that knowledge, but break them in a more effective manner. So I don't know whether that's the right thing to teach these kids, but anyway.
It's good when you have one particular teacher or something that I feel like sometimes there's teachers when you have in high school that you're probably not going to remember and things like that. But there's some teachers there, like there's always one or two things that they say that potentially might make a big difference in whatever your life direction goes in or something. It's kind of curious. And then something they might not even remember, right? They might just say something offhand, but play such a huge impact in the way people
absolutely make definitely how much decisions. Impact which potentially you could have been if you'd been a maths teacher.
Yeah, maybe.
Anyway, sorry, getting back to you, Rav, challenges. What would you say have been the main challenges over your career?
One of the big ones has probably been a communication challenge. So especially working in as a technical person, coming from a technical discipline to solve problems in the business space, just a complete lack of awareness probably of what the different ways that people think about the world are, and then being able to then solve that. That's one thing. And then when you get that a little bit more awareness of what's going on, you then have that communication problem afterwards, which is like, okay, well, now we understand a little bit about what's going on in someone's mind and how they think about some problems. But how do we then communicate on that same level about what that particular problem is, whether they even see it as a problem, and then what the kind of benefits actually are? That's always been really hard. And I feel like I've had a lot of really smart people to lean on. So I've always had some of the best projects I've worked on have been because I've got really good people supporting the project or leading the project even, that have been really good at that particular job, you know, converting technical speak to the business language.
I was just going to say, so are you saying the challenge is, you know how you mentioned about putting things into a lovely little box? People won't sit in boxes.
Exactly.
They can be unpredictable and not do as they're told and change.
Or just not see the world in boxes, right? They're just not seeing the world in these particular boxes. And that's almost always the wrong way to be seeing the world. Like sometimes it can help simplify a problem. And that can be particularly useful, especially if there's a single point that you're trying to get across or that you're trying to understand. But in general, I think it was Nicholas Taleb who kind of is a big proponent of this, which is like, focusing more on kind of heuristics and things like that and kind of more softer understanding of the world rather than kind of hard rules and hard categories and trying to put the world into different boxes. So and as a person who falls into the trap of trying to do that, I really like that way of thinking about the world. So
which is probably, and I'm going a little bit off tangent here, but it's probably a more feminine way of looking at things in that kind of softer,
I think so.
More grey, it's not black or white aspect. That is a sweeping generalization because men can think like that and women can be black and white. So I'll read a little bit more about that.
Yeah, there's another book. It's The Black Swan by Nicholas Taleb, which I really recommend.
Okay.
It's written by this guy who's an ex-trader, very academic as well, and super well read. So
would you recommend? When we finish talking, would you mind emailing me that name and then I can look it up? That'll be great. And getting back to people, you're growing your team at Alara, which is really exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about what you really look for. What are the key characteristics you look for in your new team members?
So for a company like ours, we're a small company. We're five people at the moment growing over time. But there's particular things that I think probably differ from a lot of larger organisations with. And for us, we're pretty cutting edge in what we're trying to solve. Mm-hmm. And so someone who's interested in the problem space that we're trying to solve is usually a really good sign. So if we're interviewing someone and they're asking us a lot of questions about what the problem is, if it feels really real to them, then that's usually pretty awesome. That's one thing. I think, team culture and fit to a lot of our values, so that kind of customer first, developer first kind of mindset is awesome. People who have a lot of trust as well, so that we give people quite a bit of trust, kind of do the right thing, and people who we can trust each other that we're going to deliver together and work together to solve problems. People who are quite in a bit of an innovation mindset, so people who kind of think outside the box, are happy to kind of, take the time to think about things. I'd say we're also pretty focused on having strong candor, like strong level of candor, so that we can also take good feedback, but also give good feedback, and also feel comfortable that we can say the things that we can say, and it'll be taken in good faith.
And having that psychological safety and everything,
feeling comfortable.
Absolutely, I know because I've recruited a couple of people for you, and I'm just trying to remember.
They've been absolutely stunning. Yeah,
what one of the guys said, but. It was along the lines of when he had the interview, oh, my goodness, what they are wanting to achieve has blown my mind. And he was buzzing after he'd spoken to you. So those kind of people that can really see the potential and get really excited about it. And we, as we all know, there's a talent shortage here in Australia, in the UK, the US, a lot of places in the Western world. So what do you at Alara really do to both attract and retain the people in your team?
I guess the starting point is we work with a really good recruiter who can really get on top of our the things we look for in a team member and can read between the lines between all these things that we're saying and then produce really a strong candidates for us. So that's always that's been amazing.
Thank you. It sounds like I've given you a script there, but that's really lovely. Thank you very much. And in terms of the people themselves,
how do we attract them?
It's not just attracting; it's also retaining as well because they are going to be enticed elsewhere, whether it's agency recruiters or internal recruiters or other hiring managers will be sending messages on LinkedIn or calling them. But what do you do to ensure that they're staying and building Alara?
I think there's some baseline stuff like making sure our salary is quite competitive because we're in the software space and there's a lot of organizations out there of solving different types of problems and knowing what type of business we are. We're not going to be an IBM or something like that, right? We're focused on as a startup or a startup right now. And that's really the big sell is that as a startup, we move fast. You're always going to be working on exciting stuff and you're always going to be sitting at the cutting edge in terms of the types of problems we solve. So those kinds of things that we explain about, like the kinds of experience you're going to gain while working at Alara is pretty invaluable, and it's going to be an exciting time. The kind of team culture stuff, obviously a big one. So making sure we maintain the the same kind of team values that we've had as we grow. And then also making sure we give a really clear and common goal with the team. So if we've got a really clear goal and then the people know what they're working towards, then they can give them like the solidity, right, of understanding what we're trying to achieve and feel like part of the process as well.
Absolutely. And I think as well from what you said about the trust and the candor that people know there's no ambiguity, no second guessing, which in larger organizations that can happen, and that fast-paced nature that you can't get bored, it's constantly challenging. So that's awesome. Excellent. So Rav, what do you believe are the secrets behind your success, would you say? And I know you're in the chat, so this is an opportunity for you to blow your trumpet.
Oh, I'm not particularly good at this thing. I think luck plays a huge part. I think luck in the upbringing that I had, the luck that I've had proficiencies in particular areas and then having the interest to follow them, I think has been probably a big player in how things have gone and how things go. I think one thing that's probably been a good secret is being in the right place at the right time. But I mean, that doesn't sound like a skill, but the skill I think is being able to recognize the opportunity when you're in that right place at that right time. I think that's been a big separator for me, is whenever there's been a particular opportunity come up, I've recognized that it's a particular opportunity and made big changes, right? So like you're moving across the world isn't the easiest thing. I think the first time you do it, and the time you do it after that's a lot easier than the first time you do it. But that can seem like a big step to a lot of people. But for me, the first time I did it was a little bit of a big step, but it really wasn't that big step the next time I did it. And just knowing that this is an opportunity and it doesn't come around, these opportunities don't come around all the time. And a lot of decisions you make early career seem to have a disproportionate effect on how things flow later on down the track. So just understanding those sorts of things and then making calls early. I really like this thing of like, I can't remember who, I think it might have been the guy from Freakonomics who talked about knowing when to quit. So yeah. Being able to quit early and being able to quit, I think it's been pretty, and probably something I haven't done quite as well. I don't think anyone does that quite as well as they'd like to. I think most people probably take things a little bit longer than they probably should have done. But I think I've been okay on that front. And then taking a bit of risk as well. So I think it was like Zeno of Citium who said like the people are more averse to loss than they are. So like they're more averse to the idea of loss, but when they actually do suffer through the loss, they actually end up being okay. So like they're able to quickly adapt and realize, oh, okay, actually the things that I lost didn't actually matter. So being able to understand that, I think, has made things a little bit easier to make decisions. Because I think at the end of the day, people are generally pretty good at being able to adapt, right? Like things happen and if you can, most people are able to adapt. That's almost like a human nature thing, right? So,
and that's being adaptable is a really, really key thing to success as well, rather than being very rigid in your beliefs or whatever you want to do. And coming back to what you said, I remember when we were moving to Australia, years ago, and there was myself, my husband, two children who were quite young, and my father-in-law said to me, look, we don't want you to go, but you only regret what you don't do. And it's coming back to that looking at what you get gain rather than what you're going to lose perspective. Yeah, and being in the right place at the right time, but you've got to go to lots of places to get the right. Yeah, exactly. If you're not out there talking to people, you're not going to find those opportunities. Fantastic. And finally, Rav, if you could turn back time, is there anything that you would change?
Well, it's a tricky question because I feel like if you only get to live one life, then I feel like most people, you learn exactly what lesson you need to learn when you learn it. And if you didn't go through that whatever lesson you need to learn, then you might be making a lot of the same mistakes that you were making before. But I feel like you don't recognize it to be a mistake until you learn that lesson. So I don't know if I'd particularly change any specific thing.
Yeah.
Than where I'm at right now. If I could live two lives, I think that's a different question, but like if you could live your current life and then also go back and do a completely different life, but like have them both. A parallel universe. Yeah, exactly. So like, I think if you can bifurcate and do something different, maybe I would I was particularly arty as a kid in high school, and then just completely dropped that when I focused more on the kind of sciences. But maybe I'd potentially I feel like there's maybe a different universe where I'm just a struggling artist in London or something, with probably a completely different way of looking at the world and a completely different life. But maybe that universe would be an interesting one to cross over to for a while.
I can see you busking on the streets of London and being that penniless student and penniless artist and what have you.
It'd be a completely different way of looking at the world, I think. So I think it'd be exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, as you say, you learn from the mistakes that you – are mistakes the right word? I'm not entirely sure. But everything, as you say, has some kind of meaning behind it. So thank you very much for sharing your insights, Rav. Is there anything else that you'd like to share?
No, I think I just want to say thanks for having me on your show, Nicola.
My pleasure.
Appreciate the time you've taken. And it's been exciting.
Thank you very much. And it's been fabulous to hear your story. I always find, because I obviously know the people, or quite often I know the people, I've met them before they're on the podcast. But you always find out interesting information that that you've never discovered before. So I think it's great hearing your story. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Nicola.
I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review. If you're looking for career advice, your next career opportunity, or to grow your tech team, then please call me, Nicola Steele, on 0499 773 546, or go to our website, jjptalent.com.au. The Don't Just Survive, Thrive podcast is part of the Spotlight series, which includes the YouTube channel, Spotlight on Software Development. If you want more insights into the software industry, particularly tech startups, then subscribe to the Spotlight on Software Development YouTube channel. Thank you for listening. Until next time.